the compiler thing, that when you go to the website, you type in the contract name, and what you get is, for almost every contract, the source code that is kind of human readable, which I think is a new thing, because before EVM there weren't that many decompilers that could allow you to create source, like to view the source of most of the contracts. And I built this whole thing out of frustration with Etherscan, because it only, like, it doesn't allow you to access a lot of source codes easily, and a lot of source codes are not open there. So I said, I will just build a decompiler that allows anyone to see any source, and it will be open, so anyone can start their own thing and work with it and fiddle with it. So that was one of the main motivations behind doing this. So you go to the website, and most of the contracts you see decompiled, right? And the second cool thing, which is I think even cooler, is that for every contract there is this intermediate form. So this is the same thing as this, but in this. All right, one of my friends came. All right, I'm crossing you off from the list of friends that didn't come, right? yeah, it's right. Yeah. You can write to the others that there is a list, right? All right. So anyway, there is this intermediate form, which is quite cool, because it's, I know that it looks like gibberish, but it's really a JSON representation of every single contract out there. And it's quite nice, because the way it's constructed is, it's constructed in such a way that it's very easy to analyze by machines. So we can write very simple analyzers for source codes, and you can get, you can do a lot of cool stuff, and I will talk about it in the end a little bit. So anyway, again, the decompiled form and this, right? And there are of course other tools that are in this same theme. So there is Metrio, for example, that is doing symbolic execution of every contract and tries to figure out what are the potential bugs there, right? There is Manticore that does a similar thing from Trail of Bits. And there are some other decompilers, but they decompile to Solidity, and I don't like curly brackets, if I know you also don't like them. In this quick talk and workshop, I will talk a little bit about what symbolic execution is, because that's the basis of the whole decompiler. And that's a basis for a lot of security tools and contract analysis tools. So I will explain how exactly it works. And then I will explain a few different things related to symbolic execution and how various tools solve them, so it gives you a better understanding on essentially how these things work, and perhaps it will allow you to build your own thing or just use those things better. Then I will talk about some crazy stuff that I had to do to make the results look so pretty. And in the end, I will show you a little bit more about the broader context of the whole like the compiler / contract analysis space. And I think it will take around, I don't know, an hour probably, and then we'll have some more, like a lot of time for questions and answers and more relaxed atmosphere and whatnot. All right, so symbolic execution. How many of you know what symbolic execution is? So, all right, a few of you. All right, cool. So the idea with symbolic execution is that you have, when you execute the regular code, it's always the beginnings of all the presentations people coming in and out. So you have the assembly, right? And you have the assembly code. And the virtual machine of Ethereum works by executing that code, and you know it sees, I don't know, push something on stack, and then it pushes that thing on the stack, right? Then it sees pops from stack, and pops from stack, and just executes comment by comment, right? And that's how the whole virtual machine works. Symbolic execution is essentially the same thing, but you don't deal with concrete values. So you start the program, and you know if the program says push number one on stack, you also have the stack, and you push number one on stack, right? But if the program says put call data or something that you don't know because you're not running an actual transaction, you push this variable or this symbol on the stack, right? So here, for example, this function has an assembly command saying call value, right? So it wants to push call value on the stack. regular virtual machine would just push that concrete value that was, you know, the value of the call on the stack. In my case, like, it pushes just, you know, it writes on the stack. There is some call value. I don't know what it is, but just I push it there, right? What happens then is, you know, there are other things that operate on the stack. So you know, E0 command, for example, you know, grabs a thing from the stack, negates it, and then puts it back on stack, right? It puts one if there is, if it's zero, and it puts zero if there is, if it's anything else. So with regular virtual machine, it's easy because you just have regular arithmetic. With symbolic virtual machine, you have to, like, you know, construct a special expression, and you, what you push on the stack is you push this value saying, oh, is zero call value in this example, right? Is this kind of clear? Or yeah, like, it's a little bit difficult talking to a varied audience because I don't want to, you know, bore some of the people, but I want to be still understanding the rest. So yeah, another example here, and you know, pushing this value on the stack, so now we have stack with two values, E0 and 1691. And then the fun part is when you have jumps. Because regular virtual machine, when it sees something like this, jump, if, right? Like, it just checks what's the value of the stack. If it's higher than zero, then it makes the jump. If it's zero, then it doesn't make the jump. And it's quite straightforward, it just continues execution. But when you're running a symbolic execution, you have to essentially fork the whole virtual machine and now run it in parallel, right? Because you don't know if the jump is performed or not, because you don't know what's the value of the stack, because it's E0 call value, right? So it can be anything. So you have to kind of fork the state and then execute everything below simultaneously, right? So you just, you know, call here and execute here, from this point on, right? So you kind of execute and continue execution. And yeah, and you just execute one line by line, and at the end, in case of the compilation, what I do is, whenever there is something interesting to the user that changes the state of the contract or whatnot, I print it out, right? So this things involved, revert, else, if, this is really the decompiled code, right? So if someone, if the contract writes to a storage somewhere, it would be aligned right to the storage. And all the rest, it gets just removed, right? And like, what the decompiled code is really like this trace of execution of the symbolic machine, and that's roughly it. So I know there is some kind of storage write, right? And I just write, you know, writing to the storage, and that's the part of the program that actually gets shown to the user. So at the end, for this simple function, let's ignore this. You know, we had like a series of ifs, and we went deeper here. So you know, there is if, and whatnot. So this is the decompiled form. So essentially, I just executed the whole program symbolically, and I printed out all the storage writes, all the ifs, all the reverts, everything. And this is it, right? And that took me like 2 weeks to build when I started. And by the way, I have absolutely no idea what I'm doing. So I just grabbed the CryptoKitties smart contract and I said, I want to know what's going on there. I didn't know that it's called symbolic execution, actually, like Remco told me that. So the problem with this is the output that you will actually see on some of the decompilers that use that. I think Etherscan has recently added a decompiler there. Like this is angry. Like, in reality, the function is way, way simpler, right? It's just, in reality, the function is really much, much simpler. Just the execution took so many paths that it kind of split here. So there are other algorithms in case of my decompiler that merge this. I will talk about it later. So the whole function looks like this, right? So we went from assembly code, executing it line by line, to this huge tree of execution, right? And then we folded it to something much simpler, and that's the decompiled function, one of them. Yeah?
Sorry, could you increase the font size, if possible?
Okay. It's difficult with the slides. I
Maybe you can come closer.
Yeah, I have to come closer, sorry, because I cannot redo the slides right now.
Here it's still like empty seats.
Yeah, there are some empty seats. I apologize for that. I didn't know how big would the screen be, so I cannot really right now. But I will remember for the future. Yes. I guess no one else will complain now about the. Yeah. Nah. So the other thing that that is done is for any contract, I can figure out all the functions, and then I can figure out what are the getter functions for some storages, and based on that, I can say, oh, this function returns this storage. This function's name is CFO address, so this storage's name is CFO address, and then I end up with very nice code that just doesn't have, like, that is readable, so that's it. That's like the outline of what the compiler does and how symbolic execution works. Any questions here? I will not move anyone to the front seat.
What proportion of the routines do you have to collapse to smaller?
Oh, that's I noticed some of them. It's a very satisfactory feeling when you work on that folder to collapse. Like I would say, most of them have some kind of things that need collapsing. But it was like super nice experience to work on these folding algorithms, because some of the functions initially were like, you know, screens and screens and screens in length, and then you write a good algorithm and they fold to this short and tiny thing that's super obvious. So I can't give you the proportion, but some of the functions are extremely long without this folding. I saw a question there.
Oh, well, yeah, I don't have this. Does it have to be about symbolic execution or general questions okay right now?
Yeah, general questions okay.
Okay, I'm just wondering, so like this is decompiling things to Viper?
So it's decompiling to a pseudocode really based on Python. So it's not pure Viper.
Okay. I was gonna ask like how do you handle various stuff that Viper doesn't normally do.
Yeah, so in general, like that's a question that often comes up is, can you decompile to something that can be recompiled? And really, like, it's very hard to do something that is not just some kind of a pseudocode, because exactly of the stuff that, like either Viper or Solidity, it's hard to really decompile to something that can be recompiled. So it's just,
How do you do the mapping for the function names and the function identifier? I mean, they are libraries, but you don't know all of the function names.
I will be talking about that.
Okay, awesome.
Okay, good.
Same question.
All right.
Okay, so is folding more or less the same as optimizing?
No.
I mean, is it like correct translation?
Oh, yes, it is.
Yeah, so what I mean, where I'm heading with this question is, you weren't probably on the U talk by Solidity. So they have this intermediate language, right?
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem, you know, too high level, but what they do is that they have this optimizer regulator, which is like collapsing, really. And lots of stuff, right? And maybe Viper or Solidity is not the good target for you know, this, but maybe
you
is.
Yeah, I think it's always best to try and work with existing tools, right? So
yeah, I mean, it doesn't exist either. I mean,
So it would be nice if people switch to my intermediate form. So. It's like they don't know how to team play, you know? Like, they don't want to switch to my thing. Okay, so those two questions will be answered later on. Anyway, so there are other symbolic execution engines, and there's a lot of them, and I will be talking about Kestrel Institute work and about other teams working, but like two significant ones that you might bump into. One of them is Mithril from Consensus Diligence, right? So they use a very similar process. So whenever you have to work with Mithril, like, you know, down deep, that's what they do. That's what Mithril does, and roughly. So it executes the whole code, and it tries, like one of the things that Mithril does, right, is it executes the whole code symbolically. And then Manticore from Trail of Bits, they do analysis and verification of the software, right? And they use very, very similar approach to the one that I just described. So they execute the whole program, and they just symbolically. So if you understand the symbolic execution part, you really are like you really understand how like the most significant tools on the market right now operate. It's worth spending some time to work on that. Now, symbolic execution is like this is the that was the easy part, right? And there are a few super difficult things that most of the tools don't solve properly. Sometimes neither one of them solves. And I would say out of, I don't know, 8 months, spent like full time working on this whole thing, I spent like probably half of the time doing memory handling, another half loop processing, static explosion, that was this folding thing. I did that in an afternoon, but it's like, I don't understand how it works that I got it. So I will talk a little bit about memory handling now, and then loop processing, and then move to the like tiny things that that you ask about. So memory handling. I told you how symbolic execution engine executes the program, right? And it's easy when it's just stack. So put some value on the stack, get some value from the stack. If there is an if, just split the state, what not. But what happens if someone pushes some variable on the stack and then tries to write to the memory to that value, right? Like the question is, I know as long as you write to program writes to a very concrete number in memory. So if it writes to the number, I don't know, 64, right, the virtual machine can just say, okay, at the address 64, there is this value, right? Later on, program reads from 64, it just grabs this value and executes it, right? That's very easy. You just create an array that represents the memory, and you just run it. The question is, what happens if the program takes some unknown variable, I don't know, let's say X or whatever, it says, you know, write to this memory at the position X, right? And then it says, read from memory position X plus 1. And you have to figure out, your whole execution engine now has to figure out if this X plus 1 is really, like, what's there, right? Is it the thing that was written in X and just moved, you know, slightly off? Like, perhaps it was overwritten by something else? Like, how do you deal with that? It's quite a difficult challenge, right? So you can imagine, for example, and these are the real cases, the program says, write to the memory position X, okay? So you remember that there is something at the position X. And then it says, write to the memory at position 64. So remember that it's at 64, right? And then it says, read from the memory position X. But you don't know if 64 was X, so if this memory was overwritten or not, right? So you may get stuck at some point. And it's quite, like, seriously difficult challenge. So I looked in January, it may, perhaps they improved it, at Mithril. So the way Mithril handled it was in January. So again, perhaps they fixed it. Like, whenever it reached some symbolic memory, so memory where it was written in just, you know, some variable, it just gave up. So that was the Mithril way. So you know, you have the whole execution, and then, okay, symbolic memory, I give up. I don't know. Like, next function, please. That's why you didn't have a full coverage in Mithril oftentimes. Manticore, what they did was, and that was a very similar way Ibiment at the beginning handled that, is they use like some very, very like complex structure and SMT solvers, which help with kind of managing this algebra, right? So SMT solvers help you to figure out this math when you deal with symbols, roughly. So Manticore uses SMT solvers and has these complicated memory structures. And I had that at the beginning too. The problem was that it was a little bit slow at times, and you could see that, I think, in Manticore. And the second problem was that sometimes the programs get so complicated that really doesn't cut it. So I spent like 2 months rebuilding the whole memory model to arrive at something that I will show you, which is, I think, quite neat. So, okay, this is the demo time. Can I grab a chair?
Yes.
All right, they are not locked. So, actually open sourced EVIM 2 days ago. So any one of you, it's on MIT license, any one of you can see it. And, you know, EVIM by itself, the sources are testament to the power of duct tape engineering and cowboy coding, like the best practices in those areas of programming are all implemented there. So it works quite nice, but it's been battle tested a lot of times. So it works quite nicely. You just type in the contract name or a shortcut for CryptoKitties, and it gets decompiled. So CryptoKitties take around 8 seconds to decompile fully, which I think maybe is, like, it's way, way faster than Manticore. It's around the same speed as Matrio. So anyway, you get just the sources everywhere, like for all the contracts, right? But now, the stuff I implemented just for DevCon, if you fetch idiom from GitHub, you have this parameter called explain that shows you how it works exactly, and I can increase font size here, right? So I have this one function, and this is what you saw in the previous step, right? So there is assembly, there is stack, and you can preview stuff that is happening here, right? So we have here push, right? And then you have memory load, and this gets stored as something. So cleaning up all the assembly, right? It looks like this. Whenever idiom encounters a memory read, it doesn't try to analyze it at first. So it just pushes out to the single assignment variable. Oh, there was a read from memory 64. Like I don't care like how exactly it tied to the rest of the thing. It was just a read from memory 64. It's number one, variable number one. Whenever it uses this memory, it just puts into the code, underscore one. So that's the first iteration that comes out of the initial decompilation process. And then what it does is, sorry, I need a little bit of water. Oh, ooh, and yum. So yeah, what happens then is it goes in a loop, and in a loop it tries to optimize the whole thing, clean it up, simplify it as much as possible. And in case of this function, for example, first thing that it does, it tries to inline all the variables. So it can see here, there is variable underscore one, it's being used here, so it can inline it, so it can put it here, right? Easy. Now, it doesn't put it here. And an idea why? Doesn't get inlined here. So.
Because it can be overwritten, right?
Yeah. There's a lot of things to analyze when you want to inline something. So this variable can be inlined here because it doesn't get overwritten for sure in the meantime, right? Like for sure it's not overwritten, but here, right now, like we don't know because perhaps this overrides this memory, right? So if I would just put in memory 64, like it would be incorrect because memory 64. We would mean this number 64, not this one, right? So right now it cannot be overwritten. So for the way it goes is that for every it grabs every variable and then goes line by line and checks if the value of the variable was overwritten in the meantime. Because if it was, potentially was, it has to stop the process and doesn't inline anywhere further, right? So this was the first step. It went through all the variables, inlined them wherever possible, and then the next step is, of course, inlining all the memory. The same process, right? So it grabs all the memory, and so it grabs this memory, and first this memory, right? It can put it here, right? It can put it here. Then it also sees, it checks everywhere where it can put it, and kind of we end up with already something that is slightly simpler. It goes like this in circles, and also tries to simplify whenever it can the whole thing, right? So after the next iteration, we don't have the variables here because we could finally replace this with this because this is a concrete value. Then it can simplify things. So it also goes there and tries to figure out what are the expressions that can be simplified. So it can see here that this is 96 minus 64. So it's 32. then it sees that, okay, this program returns memory, 96, 32 bytes, so this is essentially this, so it can also put it here, and then ends up with this super, super nice, very simple thing, right? So we went from this complex thing to this very tiny one-liner function. And like, it's super rewarding working on the decompiler, by the way, because like the way it is, it's like almost entering this crazy cluttered room or whatever. You see this crazy, crazy huge function, and then you see the decompiler simplifying a lot of stuff, and then you try to figure out, all right, what are the other rules that are not yet in the system that I could implement that are correct, mathematically speaking, and that would also simplify the program, right? And because EVM is so fast, like I can test it on thousands of contracts. So whenever, for every release, I can just look for contracts that weren't simplified enough and just find all the missing rules and try to simplify that and just, you know, work with that and end up with something that decompiles most of the contracts, for example. So one more thing that it does is, you know, I told you about this intermediate form. It's also quite nice because it allows us to really analyze the program very well. So, you know, it took just a few moments to write this, figure out what kind of stuff can the function return, right? So we can see that the function returns this story, for example, right? It's very simple to see if the function is payable, because we just check if there is a require at the beginning, checking for that. We can check if the function is read-only, because we can see if it uses some storage writes or some calls, right? And if we have all of those things, we can figure out that this function is really a getter. So it returns only value for a certain storage, in this case, storage 2. So if we know the name of the function, and we know that it's read-only, it means it's a getter for a given storage, so we can figure out, oh, this storage name is, we can name it after the function, and it's okay, right? It will be probably more or less correct with the original. Okay, back to the slides. Any questions here?
What happens if you return a bool, but you return the negation of the bool? So, if, for example, you don't return positive, you return the negation.
Yeah, well, so there's like a million edge cases, right? So negation is one simple thing, but then actually for booleans, I only do that for very specific function names, because there are so many various edge cases that I usually don't name storage after the booleans. For example, sometimes the booleans returned are really indexes of arrays. So, because there is a function called, are there any tokens, right? And they check if the tokens size is higher than zero. So I cannot really name the whole storage, are there any tokens, because the storage name is really tokens, right? So in this case, usually the naming is very few cases where actually it makes sense to name the storage after that. But it's funny that people ask about the namings and the functions, because like, that took like the least amount of time in the whole decompiler, right? And I remember teaching it as well. It was like, you know, first question people ask, and that was the easiest part, really. But I'm happy to answer that. Anyway, there's the second part, and that's the loop processing. And I don't think there is another tool on the market. Correct me if there are some other people from other security teams, but I don't think there is at least an open source tool that actually handles loops properly. That means that the last time I checked, either Material, Manticore, or any other, I think, decompilers, figured out loops, and I will show you what I mean. So the problem is, we have some kind of assembly, right? And the way it works in virtual machine, you write a code that is a loop that iterates over something in Solidity. It gets compressed to, like, it gets compiled to this. So, you know, push some index, jump if this index is bigger or smaller than zero, right? And then subtract, jump back, and just, you know, go in circles. So essentially this is this. Now, when we do a symbolic execution, the problem is that if we don't discover what the loops are, we will just see a series of ifs. So we will just see if x bigger than zero, decrease x, if x bigger than zero, decrease x, and just go infinitely deeper into that hole. and us, you know, continue the execution or whatever, right? This is super difficult to figure out. At what point do we figure out, I'm really in a loop, like I'm just scrolling, you know, I'm executing the same code. It's not as simple as figuring out that this, it was the same line in code, because sometimes, for various reasons, but, you know, turning this into something like this on the fly is really, like, seriously, I cannot explain exactly the algorithm because I don't fully understand what I wrote there, but it works. I kind of, you know, like this was the craziest stuff I ever wrote because I kind of understand bits and pieces of it if I focus very hard. So I think I know that it's correct, but like my mind that fails to grasp the whole complexity of what's going on there. Like I cannot imagine what's going on there. But anyway, you kind of get turned here. And I think some other symbolic tools that I saw, they don't handle this at all. So that's another place where they will break. So for example, they will just go deeper until they experience a timeout and they will say, okay, I give up, I don't analyze stuff any further. So this is another reason why I think, again, half a year ago, Mithril and Manticore would fail on a lot of contracts or a lot of actions, but they didn't make this connection, this gap here. So I will not explain exactly how this works, but the sources are public. If you can clean up the code and understand how the contract explains better than I can, go ahead, I will appreciate it. I don't know if it's physically possible, but perhaps it is. So now, don't panic. A lot of code here. But after the first iteration, the decompiler figures out, magically, let's say, that there was some kind of a loop here. Like the program encountered some kind of a loop, and there was this one index variable that starts with 0, okay? So this was the index variable. And then there was this, here the loop really ends, so index variable gets increased, and it gets back here, and it kind of executes, and then sometimes it goes to these paths, so essentially ends the program. Super unreadable, right? So it's hard to understand what's going on here. So after the first task, that's what we end up with, and that crazy algorithm like turns original assembly into something like this, which is still not nice enough. We can also figure out, okay, this is the condition, because if this doesn't get fulfilled, it will continue, and if it does, there is some other program, but there are no continues here, right? So this is the condition of the loop. And what we can do is we just look at the program and we say, all right, this looks like a while loop, so we can replace all of this with something simpler. So there is a while here, right, continue, and then the rest of the program. So like this is relatively simple compared to like the loop detection. It also shows a lot of power in just working and rewriting the whole decompiled program and, for analysis purposes. Because if this, for whatever reason, fails, like the failsafe is that we end up with something like this, which is still kind of readable, right? So there is this graceful degradation when the decompiler fails to understand something. So anyway, we end up with this, but it's still ugly, right? So we, you know, we can again inline the variables. We can again convert into So we inline variables, and then what we end up with is this loop. And I know the text is barely visible from there, like for. You know, like to make you slightly happier. If you are sitting here, like you wouldn't understand it very well because there's too many letters anyway. Right? So that's not really about it. So the thing that you have to believe back there is that this loop is really a memory copy loop. So what it does is it copies this memory from this index to this memory in a circle, right? So now the decompiler. It sees, it has certain patterns that it kind of recognizes and can, let's say, it could prove mathematically that they're really loops, and the only thing that those loops do is just move memory from one place to another. So, of course, it can remove the loops altogether, and we end up with just a statement saying, copy this memory of this land, you know, this memory to this memory. And, you know, like, the goal when I was building the decompiler was really to get rid of all the loops, because loops are, make it crazy difficult to analyze smart contracts. So, you know, like I think for 99% of the loops, we can really replace them with some other statements that are very easy to analyze with other programs. So like a lot of statements got removed and you will not actually see loops in the output code. Even though in this actual case, like the original Solidity had loops, so it simplified it even more than the original. But this is still not readable enough. Like this is some crazy numbers and whatnot. So we continue on in lining everything. So we clean up variables, you can see less text. Okay, after some more inlining, you can see more text. And actually, there was a lot of design decisions here, because sometimes, like, what do you consider simpler? What do you consider more human readable? Where should you stop, right? So my idea here was, okay, I want to inline everything at the start, like inline everything possible, remove all the loops, and then kind of, just for the human readability, kind of clean it up and perhaps add some variables here and there, so it's more readable at the end. This is kind of different from many decompilers that's just different. So anyway, this is not the best. Again, this is the same code. Now it recognized that this is really an array or return statement. So this if and all of this could be really represented by this. So this is kind of more readable, still not as well. Unfortunately, this is the best there is, but it's a part of this function. And the bad thing is, and I can honestly tell you that I think I spent just analyzing the single function, I spent probably like 2 weeks full-time work, if not more. Like I was, you know, almost waking up screaming at night and saying, ah, God, the world needs to know how simple this function is. Because this is like, yeah, because this function is really, really simple. It calls this other contract and returns whatever this contract returns. So it should, like this shouldn't be here. It should be just return this. What gets returned from this code? This should disappear really, and it should be like four lines. And you know the problem is that this single function actually breaks under certain conditions. So if I just put this line here, I cannot simplify it further and maintain the correctness of the program of the translation. It's like. No, it hurts me so much that I cannot make it any simpler, but I would lose this correctness. Sorry. But on the upside, what it means also is that there is a cool thing about the decompilation process, the way it's performed like here, is that sometimes when functions don't decompile correctly, that means that really you should look deeper and figure out what's going on there, because perhaps you know there is a reason why it wasn't simplified. Perhaps it just lacks certain rules, but perhaps there is some edge case that's there that you can exploit for profit as a black hat. You know, it's all about giving better tools to black hats so they exploit contracts sooner, so people lose less money. Like, you know, if they exploit contracts at $50, then like people will not lose millions, right? No. Anyway, the cool thing is, so this was the original function, right? And this is the final function output. So it really gets squashed and really simplified. And again, super rewarding process when you see this huge, huge function, you wonder what the hell is going on here, and then you end up with something that is almost as simple as possible. Yeah, so any questions here?
Do you construct control flow graph while you decompile it?
No. Well, not in a traditional sense. Like the question is, many decompilers do this static analysis thing where they try to figure out, they kind of try to look at what the compiler did, use some of the hints to split the program into chunks, and then create a graph and try to work from that graph, right? So I think that's what Trail of Bits do. Yeah. And here I don't do that. I try to avoid any compiler-specific patterns, like looking at compiler-specific patterns, and that's what often, this control flow oftentimes, you know, assumes there are certain things on the stack or that there is certain structure, and here, no, not always, but sometimes, and there are other tiny things that this thing is actually better.
Yeah, but if you have a control flow graph, then binding loop is much easier if you apply the traditional structural analysis on with the control flow graph.
Well, some things are easier, and there is, for example, no state explosion. So if there are like five heaps in a row, like this approach will break because it will explode in complexity trying to analyze every path, right? On the other hand, control flow, like the, you know, people were working on that. They didn't succeed, right? So they need to either step up their game with
that. Yeah, actually, the past explosion is problem of the simple execution. Hmm? But the past explosion is the problem of the simple execution.
Yeah.
Yeah, but if you apply the static analysis technique a little bit, then you can you can get a much easy and nice control program. And
yeah.
You can get some more structural visual.
Yeah, I agree.
There is it's just an opinion.
Yeah, I agree. There is a lot more that can be done here, and there are also like amazing work from Kestrel, where they work on a similar thing, but they did it for Java, where the programs were much more complex, it's a lot to talk about. But yeah, there were two other questions here.
If you're reading like from storage. Do you try to make any assumptions what the value could be, like on logic or on contract?
No, not at this stage. So no assumptions. Although there is a part that I will talk about it in a moment where I try to analyze the structure of the storage, but that's mostly for the naming purposes. But no, there are no assumptions about what exactly the storage structure or the storage variables are at that point. But I think that the output. Could be then analyzed, and like some cool stuff would be possible there. I hope that this answers the question. Okay. Yeah.
Oh, I kind of have multiple questions mm-hmm. here, but let me follow up with that. And I noticed in your output there are things where like you have a storage variable declared as an address, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, how do you determine that sort of thing?
Okay, that I will talk about that in a second.
Okay. Well. Okay, and so let me ask the other question, which is, I'm just wondering, is it possible at all for you to handle, jumps to, like, a variable location, like, say, one that's read from storage?
That's one of the benefits compared to the control flow. Yeah, this actually handles this kind of stuff quite smoothly.
Wow.
And, yes, I have to talk. Yeah, because, like, you execute. Actually, the current version is not as smooth as the previous one, but you actually, you know, you just execute all the jumps and whatnot. So, like with other tools that are more in line with the static analysis of control flow, they oftentimes got lost or they displayed improper results when someone calculated the jump location or on the fly. Mm-hmm. Here, it just calculates it also on the fly, right, and ends up with proper jumps. But the question is, what happens if you, Remco gave some good examples here, for contracts that would probe the other compilers. But anyway, what happens if you jump to a location from the storage, right? So,
yeah.
So right now, the way this handles it, it will just show it's a jump to a storage location of a given number, right? I don't think I encountered many contracts in wild that do that, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's a common thing, but
yeah.
I was wondering, because like you can totally do that in Solidity, so.
You can do so many things.
Do you know one?
What?
Do you know one example of these?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, CTFs possibly.
Okay.
And there are other examples that are closer to that, for example, job tables, right? So you, like, current core with a brain fact interpreter in Solidity, right? Solidity. So this approach can be used to handle that. And the original approach actually used it quite nicely when it had some jump locations in the memory and whatnot. The current version doesn't work with that as smoothly, but you know, if there was a need, like yeah, this approach can be used to handle that. I kind of try to work on the examples of real contracts, but keep in mind that you know, if there are more contracts that have this pattern, then yeah, it can be extended to handle that as well. There was a question from here, I guess.
I want to ask about, so you have like a bunch of roles that you apply, so like you can think about it. Do you have to think carefully about having a role that maybe stops another role from applying? Like maybe it's a real implementation, and by applying one too early, you like make the pattern not match.
Yeah, I was afraid of this kind of roles, because like if you simplify, well, what do you simplify to, right? And if you add some other role, perhaps it simplifies to something that brings the other roles in turn. So fortunately, there weren't that many cases of this, so somehow it works without causing these problems. There were some cases, but then you can you know do various steps. So you're doing a loop, and you know you have this set of rules, and then you have another set of rules and other kinds of simplifications. So it's doable. But yeah, it is some kind of a complexity that yeah potentially could cause problems, but it's not very common. So fortunately, that's nice.
Yeah. As earlier it was compared to control flow, data flow approach, there are different approaches and each has pros and cons, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes it may be the case that different approaches may be good for different parts of the program.
Yeah.
Would you see this as feasible to make some like hybrid combined approach where you, I think, try to figure out which parts should be treated by which tools? Maybe with some maybe evolutionary algorithm, something like this on the top, trying to pick
the best
algorithm for parts and later combining this into maybe later better purified results. Do you see this maybe happening?
Theory, maybe happening. I think what happens really is people just use various decompilers, various tools, and see which ones deliver the best outcome for a given function and whatnot. So I think that's really realistically it will be this. Like this approach, like the way I implemented it at least, like it really like it doesn't work well with the state explosion, but there are ways to make this approach work just as good even in these cases. So yeah. But
I think it's like Roger that from your perspective it's just you know maybe nice idea but in practice it's not work because it's a lot of work while you can manually like copy and paste the file in a compiler to another tool.
Yeah, because I think you would need like to integrate two various systems.
It's very complex.
Yeah, it's very complex. So there are other things that would be more valuable to doing, yeah, I would say so. But you know, like if that passionate.
But still I ask like maybe you would say no, it would be easy, right? Curious.
How do you actually verify the correctness of the compiled code?
It's not very correct. No, I'm just kidding. but actually, no, I'm half kidding about that. Well, there are a few ways. I think I have a slide on that, so I will get back to that. Yeah, in a moment as well. All right? Okay. Let me. I try to remember everything and all the threads that didn't come, so like a lot of things to hold in mind. Okay. So one more thing that I wanted to talk about before I come to the part where I explain all the answers to all the questions that were here. I mentioned already the JSON representation at the beginning, and I wanted to talk very shortly about it, why either this or someone else will make something very similar is very, very cool. So the cool thing about this series of small letters that people from the back don't see is that it's extremely simplified. So compared to just grabbing Solidity or the stuff that people do with Lua, this doesn't have, for example, recursive functions or anything like that. It usually doesn't have loops. It doesn't have memory access. This is almost a functional representation of every function in smart contracts. And this makes it very, very easy to analyze by automated tools. So there's a lot of cool use cases that were there. It actually took all of this in a BigQuery database, so you can search it with JavaScript in 20 seconds. And there were some cool use cases, so Constantinople and chain security people that covered the problem with Constantinople. Like, when there was the Constantinople fork, for example, the question was, you know, some changes in the protocol may affect some of the contracts. But how do we figure out which contracts will be affected by some changes? We need to figure out, we need to find and search through that, right? So the way we actually found contracts that are really vulnerable to a certain exploit was by grabbing all of that from the database and searching in JavaScript for all the contracts that match a certain pattern. And I think this was one of the two tools that actually managed to do, to get the job done with a lot of help and cooperation with the chain security people. So you know, a huge potential also for like some other stuff that I did was finding all the tokens that don't check transfer function properly and allow anyone to print as many tokens as you want. That was like 5 lines of JavaScript to analyze this thing. And there were like hundreds of contracts where you could print your own tokens because they messed up the coding. That was hilarious. 5 of them actually valid contracts that someone had some money on. So I had to check before releasing that if they are still online. So there were some like sad stories, you know, don't use this contract anymore, like we've been hacked and whatnot. So a lot of fun. But I also think that this approach, in general, that the compilation and this intermediate form and working like this, like rewriting the code, is very important for auditing. And I wouldn't say that it will replace Solidity code auditing in full, because that gives like certain benefits still, but really working bottom up and taking the virtual machine and just, you know, turning it, this into some intermediate form language that has a lot of benefit and allows to make very, very good tools for auditing. And I would see not necessarily my thing, and if you check the sources, you will see why not my thing is pretty dirty. But something like that, I think that's really the path for the community to go, or at least one of the important paths.
Is it very different than LLL? Is it very different than LLL?
What do you mean?
Like low level, there's like a Lisp one. It actually looks really similar to that, but uses like...
I didn't know that one.
Okay, fair.
LLL?
I think it's, yeah, it was like the original before Solidity. It's like a, it's very Lispy. It looks kind of like this, actually.
Yeah, like, fell in love in Lisp after I learned from Eric that it's very, very similar to Lisp. So, sure. So yeah, like it's similar. I wasn't aware of LLL, so I have to check it out now.
Okay.
Give me a friend. I will talk about one more thing before I get to the questions. Okay, that was supposed to be one more thing. Okay, one more thing. So there is a lot of math going on there in every compiler, symbolic analysis tool. And most of the tools use SMT solvers. So these black boxes where you put in math and you get the results. And they are very nice because, first of all, they are solid, right? Like they've been written by smart people, battle tested for a long time, and they cover all the cases. So they work very nicely. But I think, surprisingly, like having a set of rules that were handwritten had problems, a lot of problems, but can be sometimes faster. And I want to talk a little bit about how math is handled in my case, perhaps as a comparison. And I'm not saying this is better, perhaps it's worse, but I just started doing this way because honestly a year ago I didn't know what SMT solvers were, so I just wrote it my way, but perhaps it's not the best way. So in my case, getting to the Python implementation, like I don't use classes for representing the whole program, I use tuples. So this is very similar to like actually like the way Lisp would represent it. So, you know, every operation, like if I put something on the stack, I don't know the value, it's not a class of something, it's just a tuple. So tuples are so nice because they are very easy to compare, for example. So if I want to cache some computations, I just, you know, it's very, like in Python at least, it's like one operation to compare two tuples if they are equal. So it's all one time. So it speeds up a lot of computations because I cache like crazy. The second cool thing is, working with this, is I have the printout form that's human readable, but when I want to test it in Python, I just copy it to the code, and it's, you know, it's already there, so I don't need to create constructors and whatnot. So this is very, very nice, but sometimes, like, you know, when you are getting used to that, it can hurt your eyes a little bit. Now, the other thing is, I also try to flatten and simplify all the forms of expressions. So SMT solvers also do that, like simplify stuff. But I have a very special, like canonical flattened form that for a human, it might not be the simplest one, but like a lot of math really assumes that there is this form, so it saves a lot of processing time analyzing all the rules. I don't want to go too deep into that, but for example, you know, when I multiply something, the concrete value is always as a first argument, or there is a certain order of operations. So if I see multiply, add something, multiply, it will be always add and multiply, not like this, and not the other way around. So because of this, like the whole math library can really have like a certain very small set of rules and analyze just them. It doesn't have to rediscover the whole I think it's faster in some cases at the cost of the generalization perhaps. And then I had to invent my custom operator. So anyone that worked deep with the bytecode knows that shift left happens a lot of times in the contracts. You like shift all the stuff and move things bit by bit, byte by byte, and you mask a lot. So you know, let's say that you have a big number, you want to cut off this center here because that's where something is, and you move it to the left or to the right, right? So like these operators are used a lot, and I simplify I simplify all the multiplications, divisions first to these operators. So a lot of the stuff will be way, way simpler. And then I have this special operator, mask and shift left, which is like super difficult to figure out, understand, and memorize. But it really like cleans up a lot of the output. So essentially, mask SHL is the special operator that was invented that handles a lot of operations that otherwise would be these complicated trees of expressions. And I think that's another part where the decompiler gets its speed, because it really has just one operator, whereas the regular analyzers would have like a huge tree of operators, and they would have to figure out each single time like how they tie together. I'm not 100% sure. I'm not like a SMT specialist and whatnot, but like this stuff is fast. So that's my bet why it is so. Now, obviously, yeah, disadvantages. It's homebrew, like the code is absurdly bad, so if anyone wants to tackle that, good luck. And yeah, it's a little bit clunky, but then like all the rules, all the math rules were really battle tested on all the contracts on the mainnet, so really like it works. And yeah, it may be quite fast, and another cool thing is that it is kind of transparent compared to SMT solvers, which are often this kind of black boxes, but the code quality is so low that I'm not sure if it's so transparent. and let me see. Yeah, okay, the next slide is the answer to the questions. So I built the whole thing in Python, and Python doesn't have pattern matching, and that sucks, because a lot of work with decompilers is really pattern matching. So you try to figure out there is this pattern in the tuples, and you replace it with some other patterns. So for anyone that will want to try out the code, I had to fix Python and invent custom statements. And you know, advanced programmers know that this is not what you do usually, right? You don't change the language to match your purpose. But whenever, like if you go into the sources, you will see a new operator that's actually pattern matching, that handles pattern matching in Python. And I managed to do that without fixing the interpreter. So you just run plain vanilla Python 3.8, and you can use pattern matching in your own programs. So that's quite neat and really simplifies a lot of things. Python 3.8 is required for this. It releases next week. They didn't want to push the premiere to today, so we have to wait for the official release. Anyway, yes. So now it's a few answers finally to the questions. Then I will talk a little bit about the other tools, and then we have a more relaxed way. And I can see that some people were getting too impatient. So yeah. First of all, there was a question about the functional identifiers, right? So the way it works for anyone that's not yet familiar, Solidity and the whole like EVM, all the contracts use identify functions by 4 bytes. So you take the function name, you hash it, and you grab the first 4 bytes of that hash, and that's the identifier. So that every contract has these functions and only those 4 bytes as an identifier. Fortunately, someone built a database of 4-byte directory, it's called, so it's kind of, you know, it has all the function names and all the identifiers. Unfortunately, it's not that good. It doesn't have a lot of stuff, and some of the functions, I think someone brute forced to find collisions, so you can find a lot of common functions that just have other definitions that are total rubbish. So I had to build my own 4-byte directory. Essentially, I just grabbed all the APIs that were there, and I absolutely hate scraping Etherscan, but this was the only one situation that I had to do that. So I grabbed all the APIs, I put them in the box, and I built my own directory. So if you download the sources, like on the first run, it will download, because it's a huge file, it will download all the 4 bytes into your drive, SQLite database. So if there is anything, like if you're playing with contracts and you want to have a really good library of function definitions, that's where you can get that.
How do you actually handle collisions now in your code?
Yeah.
You have to pick one anyway.
So, like the case I love is transfer function, right? Was transfer or transfer from? Because it has, like if the parameters were completely different, like that could be handled quite easily, right? But in case of transfer, the problem is that ERC20 tokens transfer, the first second parameter is value, and ERC721, it's item number or token number, token ID, right? So it's different names, and that's quite irritating because there is no way you can figure that out from the source. It requires human knowledge. So that's why the file with 4 bytes directory, like the way I implemented it, is so big. I kind of figured, I look for correlations, so I see, oh, this name of the function usually appears with these other functions, and this appears with these other functions, and then it looks which are more similar, and tries to guess based on that.
By the way, aside from the funny fact, I was one of the guys that scraped Etherscan and submitted everything to 4 bytes directory because I wanted to use that service.
Oh, right.
And also had the same problem, and I wanted to detect it from that perspective, and I'm actually trying to infer what type of arguments I see, and then pick the right function definition from that side.
Yeah, so okay, thanks a lot for scraping Etherscan.
Thanks a lot also for you for making some traffic on Etherscan.
yeah, I like really like this, a lot of this project came out of frustration for Etherscan not providing the APIs. Like we were so dependent, like if it was all the contracts published on Facebook, like people would be like pitchforks, right? But it's all the contracts are on the private company's servers that doesn't allow easy access and no pitchforks. So like so again, thank you. Having said all that, the function doesn't work properly, so I don't distinguish that very well. But it should be improved. Yeah, like it could be improved. The data is there, just no time to handle that. There is another cool thing or interesting thing that when I decompile and try to figure out the storage access, the storage when you have to access arrays or mappings, it's like you know a hash of a number plus something, right? So when Solidity or like contract wants to access array number, array at storage number 2, position something, it has to hash number 2 and add something, right? So usually I just see hash of this, add something, that's easy, understandable, good. Unfortunately, in some cases, like the compiler kind of hashes in advance everything, so just puts a big number there, and you know the output is a big number that breaks everything and breaks understanding of the contract because you just see read storage number 1, right? Super irritating. So I had to do a rainbow table of that, so to speak. So I just, for some courage, I just precalculated some of that. So I reverse engineer hashing. I should have called the function reverse SHA3, right? So that's the thing. Thanks. There is the contract search, so like I put all the data there on the BigQuery. Another fun thing that I did on the hackathon, I probably will release that sometime tomorrow, next week. Like I actually indexed all the contracts and created this instant search for contracts, so we can search contracts by vulnerability. So it takes like 100 milliseconds, and you can say, show me contracts that don't check for owner who is calling them before changing the owner, right? And it instantly finds all the contracts like that. And it would be super fun treasure hunt when I release that, because it's like hilarious stuff that can be done. Like, I want to write a script that just changes contracts, owners of, you know, of contracts to one another. I will do that. That would be responsible. But if someone does it, I think that would be hilarious, right? Anyway, testing. Who asked about the testing?
I have a different question, actually. Like, whenever people create compilers, there's other people that are going to create decompilers, and then there's the next set of people that are going to build obfuscation techniques to actually make it out of decompilers. You just built a decompiler. What are the edge cases that you can think of or already saw? I make it very hard for you to actually.
I have that on the next slide. All right, another questions here or?
So what's with the Chandra, because hashes are used for storage locations, both for dynamic arrays and for mappings, and like, so does this come up with the, does this pre-computation problem come up with mappings as well, or are you able to just like, you know, or does it never pre-compute those in your mind?
I will kind of try to get to that in the, when I get here. So there was a question about testing, how I tested and whether this whole thing is valid. So first of all, it is not valid. Like, don't trust 100% the output that it provides. The idea was to give a brief, like, no, it will allow you to find bugs, but not finding bugs in the contract doesn't mean that the contract is fine. Like, again, there was a lot of duct tape engineering involved in building this whole thing. I'm quite sure that the approach is valid, and again, people from Kestrel are working on a very similar thing, just formally verified. So I hope one day we'll see this approach, but with formally verified basis, or like very, very solid. So talk to Eric if you're interested in that thing. Having said that, the way I test it usually is I have a few cases, so a few contracts with edge cases. CryptoKitties is always a must for me, like it has a lot of nice edge cases. And I have just a few basic contracts that I check how they compare between various versions of the decompiler. And then the second thing I do, again, I pushed for speed a lot, right? So it's possible to decompile the whole blockchain within one day, I think, right? And go, so CryptoKitties takes 8 seconds, it used to be 2, but like really pushed the speed. So before release or after every update, I can just go through hundreds of contracts and kind of see what's changed or see some patterns and whatnot. And also when there is some new stuff, I can say, oh, just show me some contracts that have a certain pattern and let's see how it's implemented there. So it's kind of, not the perfect testing mechanism, but so far it's been kind of successful. Like the ideal and gold standard would be to have a recompiler from the decompiled source, right? And recompile all the decompiled contracts, run the whole blockchain history, and then see how correct it is, right? So the transactions return the same thing, and that would show very nicely how much of it is correct, like most of it, not perhaps again not the edge cases, but that would be super, super nice. And this is battle tested, so if you get the GitHub source, like command line, I played with some other tools, and it was like, oh, you have to download this binary, and it has to be real runtime, and then you run it, and there are some bugs. Like, really, like the command line is as simple, and it works as smoothly as possible. Assuming you have Python 3.8, so that's the problem. Okay, I won't go into folding too much. Storage mapping, there were a few questions about storage, right? So can you repeat your question?
Oh, okay, so you were talking about, having these pre-computed random tables for, for dynamic arrays, this is not too hard, because, I mean, they're not going to be, like, the numbers that are going to be plugged in are fairly small,
yeah.
So, you know what your range there is, you're not going to see enormous arrays, and then maybe you can do this a few levels down, it's not too bad. But then there's the question of mappings, and because with mappings, you could maybe see huge numbers put in, or the domain doesn't have to be numbers. Even with numbers, that's enough to expose the problem. So I was wondering, since you didn't mention that, is there no problem with mappings because they don't pre-compute it for mappings, or do they pre-compute it with mappings and you have to expand your technique?
Fortunately, usually like they are not compared with that.
Okay.
Usually when you deal also with mappings, usually, you know, they have to be computed on the fly because the mapping depends on some user input or whatever.
Right.
But sometimes, adding to you, yeah, I noticed some contracts, for example, don't use storage number 2. They use the person from Zeppelin just left, but they have some proxy contract that actually has storage that doesn't have the number. It's like it's not indexed by number, but it's really org.zeppelin.something hash that, right? So in that case, I also have I have a table, I think, with one or two cases. And the cool thing with working with this approach is actually what I did was I was running the decompiler and saying, okay, show me all the big numbers that are used as storage indexes and that are not yet reverse engineered. And you know, I took a look at some of them. So this is very neat working this way, because you just say, okay, let's see what I still didn't take into consideration, right? And I'm not saying that this is perfect, but like works for a lot of things, and it's easy to extend, right? So when there is a new pattern, you can solve that. I think, yeah, like storage mapping in general, some crazy stuff there. If you go into the source code of this, like that was done right before the release, like, you know, you don't want to imagine my mindset when I was working on that, but like some crazy hacks there. But essentially, like, it's very difficult to map storage. If you want to decompile properly, you have to figure out this storage is, you know, storage number 2, it's an array, and this is the index of the array, and this is really a structure and whatnot. Like, very, very difficult. Well, it kind of gets solved, so if you want to see, like, I will not even attempt to explain how it's done, but it's done, and not perfect, but yeah, it's, I think, one of the open challenges to really do that well. Okay, I will briefly mention the folding algorithm. So I told you that there is this state explosion. Like, you have a lot of ifs, and then you want to fold them, so it's really like a very short thing. So I will try to explain the algorithm, because it's hilarious, try to explain it. So you know how you have diffing? Like, you have diff between two files, right? So now, the way I do it is, I take all the execution paths, I split them into linear forms, all right? So I do something like diff, but not for 2, but like for 100 at the same time, right? So I merge that to a kind of a tree, and then I do a diff on the trees, multiple trees inside, and I kind of merge them together. So that's, I cannot really like imagine how it works exactly, but it's roughly that. So the code is super anti-transparent. If you can figure out a nice way, or if you can improve using some knowledge from the other, fields, go ahead. And yeah. So finally, a few, and now I'm getting to the CDF, see? So this is the edge cases first. So yeah, there is this kind of, personally, there is not that much abstraction of like, the people don't try to make the code that is unreadable that much. I found some of the code that was super easily parsed, and obviously it was meant as some kind of a security practice. And some of the code was used to even block some of the money from being withdrawn. So like, that's not a good, like, security is not a good long-term practice. And I wanted to say, when it comes to CDFs, you know, when I started checking CDFs, I was kind of sad because if it didn't work well with CDFs, and then it hit me, perhaps the CDF creators really have to check with EVM before releasing a CDF. I hope they do by now, right? So I'm not that sad anymore, because I think there was this guy that had to check for that. And actually, I spent a lot of time on some weird edge cases, thinking of that guy that will be doing a CDF one day, and he would think that he's so smart, and then EVM will solve it smoothly, and then I will, in my mind, say to him, like, in your face, right? So I hope that there was at least one situation where someone tried to create a CDF, and there was that in your face moment where it went smoothly. So anyway, that's the CDFs, and I try to not spend too much time on them, because like, there is enough difficult stuff with the regular contract. But yeah, like, it's a cool stuff. So Kestrel, I'm giving the first spot as a kudo, because they are doing an awesome thing and very few people know about them. So talk to Eric if you have a chance. Yeah, that's Eric. So they did, like, the whole institute is about program synthesis. It was created 30 years ago in Silicon Valley. And they did very similar stuff, just way, a better in Lisp, ACL2, formally proven, and it works for way more difficult stuff than smart contracts. So for Java programs, right? And for cryptographic libraries. And I hope that they get the grants or whatnot to really push that into our space. Second thing is contract library. So this is another decompiler. I love the guys. Their code, their website looks like crap, but it's really good underneath. So it's really like it has an awesome technology underneath. Like similar in spirit, they just use more declarative languages. So like if you want to work with someone, like they are very good guys. Material, I mentioned it already, like very similar in spirit and very nice. K-Labs, so I guess most of us know here K-Labs and formal verification and stuff that was done around Maker. Like the stuff that is symbolic execution and the stuff that they are doing, kind of similar in spirit again. So if you get symbolic execution, it will be easier to get what K-Labs is doing. Although I still don't get it fully. So Manticore, Trail of Bits, again. Now, shout out to BigQuery because it's like I put all the stuff there, and really there is a team from BigQuery that is very much into blockchain and Ethereum, and they are very easy to reach. So if you want to play with BigQuery, there are people from Google that really, you know, that want to support that. And there are two cool blockchain explorers, BlockCInfo run by Alexei. Like a lot of cool data there, analytics and whatnot. Very open to cooperation. And BlockScout, I'm actually talking to BlockScout, and there may be integration, so they may show sources from EVM over there. Because I think like the problem with Etherscan is that they are the only ones or one of the few that have the access to the sources, and the others have to scrape from them. So if we can have better decompiled sources, it kind of levels the ground, because other blockchain explorers can also show sources for everyone. Finally, chain security. I can see the t-shirts here. Yeah, like thanks a lot for that mention in the January article, but also like very good work. And Bandstamp, also very good project that we all know. And yeah, this is the last slide, I think. Python gets released next week, so anyone can work on the production Python. Sources available, MIT license. And yeah, it would be just playing. So finally, I wanted to say like a few words, like what's my approach with the project, what are the final next steps. So really, like I did EVM over the last year to as a creative outlet, so to speak. So I just wanted, you know, I was frustrated with not knowing what the contracts do, and was filled with anger, like a lot of anger just put into this, so finally figured it out. And there was no business purpose there was nothing else. I could afford some time to just go deep and see how far I can go with that. And having said all that, like I feel kind of accomplished in this aspect, so I hope that the community will use all this knowledge that I can help other projects really with adding some better stuff to the blockchain. And yeah, that's why I'm super open about the MIT license, anyone using the algorithms and whatnot. Like for me, the purpose of the whole project is accomplished already. And you know, I'm happy to see everyone here, and I'm happy to open, you know, answer any questions and just help out however I can. And yeah, I hope that someone will use the sources. So yeah, I guess this is the moment for thank you. Yeah, and yeah.